Welcome in to the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. I'm excited about today's show, folks. Today we're going to take a slight turn to the left. We're going to go from true crime books to true crime fiction, which I'm excited about this as well. We're bringing back an old friend, Ron Francell, as he has a brand new book out there called Death Row. Not like Death Row Records or Death Row, the place where you sit in jail, but Death Row. It's coming out in a few weeks. And we're going to talk a little bit about this book. And I tell you, I spent some time with this book and I absolutely fell in love with the characters in this book. We're going to talk a little bit about that. In case you're not familiar with Ron Francell or you're catching up with Ron, he's a veteran journalist with 18 books to his credit, including international bestsellers The Darkest Night and Edgar-nominated true crime Morgue, A Life in Death. His latest true crime, Shadow Man, An Elusive Psycho Killer, and The Birth of FBI Profiling, was released in 2022 by Berkeley Penguin Random House. His atmospheric and muscular writing, hailed by Anne Rule, Vincent Bugliosi, and others, has established him as one of the most provocative voices in narrative nonfiction. But his newest title that we're going to talk about today, Death Row, signals a return to crime fiction for the first time in 20 years, a happy side effect of the COVID pandemic that made Ron's robust boots-on-the-ground research impossible. Wild Blue Press, by the way, who he's released Death Row through, reissued his earliest mysteries, The Deadline and The Obituary. Ron's first book, Angel Fire, was a literary novel that became a USA Today bestseller and eventually was listed by the San Francisco Chronicle among the 100 best novels of the 20th century West. His later success grew from blending techniques of fiction writing and with his daily journalism. The result was dramatic, detailed, and utterly true storytelling. Ron has established himself as a plucky reporter, too, as a senior writer at the Denver Post. He covered the evolution of the American West, but shortly after 9/11, he was dispatched by the Post to cover the Middle East during the first months of the War on Terror. In 2004, he covered the devastating Hurricane Rita from inside the storm. He also won the Associated Press Managing Editor's National Freedom of Information Award for investigative reporting. Ladies and gentlemen, let's welcome back to True Crime Tuesday, Ron Francell. Ron, how you doing today?
Hey, Tim, I'm doing great. I, when I hear an introduction like that, it makes me wonder if you've got the right guy.
Yes, I do.
I love sitting here in northern New Mexico, and I put hay out for the wild horses, and we pick a few grapes and watch football.
That sounds wonderful. I'm sitting here in snowy Minnesota, freezing my butt off, and yeah, it's nothing like New Mexico, that's for sure, my friend.
Nothing like New Mexico, I guarantee you.
No. I love the fact that you've come back to crime fiction, and I love the fact that, you know, as I sat down with Death Row, Ron, that the characters are so rich in this story, that the story itself has so many twists and turns, and that you've come up with a lead character in Woodrow Bell, Mountain Bell, that is gotten back to the old codger who, let's just say he's a little grizzled. He's the guy who doesn't necessarily want his feelings to be, you know, put out there for all to be displayed.
Yeah.
He's a little old school, but at the same time, he's willing to adapt, but not too quickly. And at the same time, he does have that soft side. He just doesn't want you to know about it, but we're getting to look at his soft side as well. And he's learning to adapt to the newer ways of crime fighting and solving these crimes. And he's being dragged out from retirement willingly yet unwillingly. And he's got his own set of problems.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. That's a good way to put it.
Yeah. Tell us a little bit about Woodrow Bell and where does he come from? Where did you get him from?
Woodrow Bell, who of course I know as Mountain Bell, it's his nickname given to him when he was, you know, a young Marine in Vietnam, because he's a big guy. Mm-hmm. And throughout the writing of this book, I imagined him I imagine Brian Dennehy playing him. So that gives you a sense of sort of his bulk, his presence. And that's the kind of guy I wanted. I know guys like that. And so you take, I think a fiction writer always takes bits and pieces of real people and puts them together in a kind of pleasant Frankenstein's monster in every character. And that's what I did with him. He's a retired gunnery sergeant from Vietnam, goes into the law enforcement, works at the Denver Police Department, rises up to be a homicide detective. He's been through the wars. I mean, you know, he's seen it all. He's this crusty, cynical, reclusive old fart that you described, who he really just wants to fade away. It's his closest friend, who's a retired priest, who has his own unorthodox past that brings him this long forgotten small town cold case in this little dinky town where he has retired in the Colorado Rockies. And Bell's natural reaction is to sort of growl and harumph, but the more he learns, the more he can't look away. And but he's facing a big problem. He's only now a retired cop, so he has none of those high-tech forensic tools that he once had in the big city, and he isn't taken seriously by local cops, who think, you know, you're just a gray-haired old guy, you know, acting on a hobby here. So, what Death Row is comes. He finds a way to use these old guys that he meets for coffee every morning in the small town diner. Now, every small town diner has a bunch of old guys who gather up on most mornings to fix what's wrong with the world, to tell their tall tales, to poke fun of each other, to remember their glory days. This diner in Midnight, Colorado, the small town that I invented for this story, it's no different. There are six or seven old codgers who get together, all of them in their 70s or 80s. Their best days are behind them. And they call themselves Death Row, deaf as in can't hear.
Right.
So now Bell might not have the computers or the laboratories or the science that the Denver Police Department had, but he has these six or seven guys, and they're a motley crew. You know, there's the retired chemistry teacher from the high school, the retired newspaper editor, retired doctor, retired fire chief, who was fired, by the way, because he had a drunken fire truck racing incident.
I love that, by the way, Ron.
But together they get on this investigation, and it quickly proves to be a bigger, badder case than any of them imagined, even including Woodrow Bell. So in the end, you know, it's a classical mystery. We have these guys trying to put their heads together and divine the name, or at least the profile, of a very bad man.
And what's interesting is, as things unfold, there's not only newer technology that Mountain Bell has to embrace, but at the same time, he's depending just as much on hearsay, rumor, and stories of the community as he is the newer technology, without putting spoilers out there, which I find just as endearing as well. And he is, as you put it, he's leaning on this motley crew of people down at Tommyknockers, which is the name of this cafe, where he goes every morning to meet the Death Row gang. And that's what I find so endearing about this book, Ron. The fact that you can be any age, you don't have to be an old fart sitting down, which I love the fact that you keep using the term old fart as in the book, and sit down and be able to almost, what's the words I'm looking for here? Relate to this group of old farts at a cafe. You can do it.
It's exactly it. We all know those guys, don't we?
Yeah, we all know them.
If it's they're everywhere,
right?
They're all around us. But here's the thing: these guys had their day. They contributed to the world in their own unique ways. They raised kids. They loved their wives. They enjoyed life. Everything was as it should be, but now they're getting old and they're disappearing. They're turning invisible. And I think that weighs on all men as they reach a certain age, that their best days are behind them, that the reason they are here has passed. That now they're just hanging around, and the best thing they can do is get together and poke fun at each other and tell tall tales.
I do have to, before you go any further, Ron, I do have to pay my respects and kudos to you for bringing up that theme throughout the book. 'Cause it's one of those themes that you wouldn't typically see in true crime fiction. Normally it's just the facts, man. We get right down to this case, and if the character has a flaw, it tends to be more of a human flaw of not noticing something in the case, or and then, oops, we get to it at the end. The flaw here might be that we're a little too human and we see our mortality a little too much in the work that we're doing. And what's funny is throughout the book, each character sees their mortality in this case that Mountain Bell is tackling, even Mountain Bell himself, which again, I have to tip my cap to you, my friend, in that it isn't necessarily the fact that these old farts are sitting on a stool every morning and looking at each other. And they are at the beginning, they're staring into their breakfast. And as they're cutting up with each other, they're saying, you know, I am getting a little older and the end is coming near, and maybe I'm questioning what comes next. But then as things start to develop, they're realizing, you know what? Life is shorter than I really thought. And the end can come sooner than what I think. And they really are starting to question what their role is in this world. And things get deeper as we get deeper into the book.
Yeah.
And that is a brilliant stroke of genius.
Thank you for that. I'm going to quote you on the book now.
Please do. Please do.
But you know, it's either been the blessing or the curse of my book writing career. I just don't want to do it like everybody else is doing it. For my true crime and for my journalism, I blended true storytelling, but was telling with the techniques that a fiction writer would use. Now, I don't mean making things up. I mean things like foreshadowing what's to come and cliffhangers and a bit of drama in there so that I could tell a true story like Shadow Man, but tell it in a way that people would keep turning the page to see what happens, and that they would invest their sympathy in one or more characters and want to know what happens to them, really, truly care what happens to them. So along comes COVID, and I now can't do the kind of research that I do. Mm-hmm. And I decided to do Death Row. I then wanted to blend commercial crime fiction, you know, just telling a good story about a crime and an investigation, with a kind of literary exploration of men who've outlived their best days, who are now growing invisible, like I said, and who we don't see a lot of in our media as heroes, right? I mean, right. We occasionally do. We occasionally see old guys in a sort of Sunshine Boys role or something like that, or Secondhand Lions. They're not invisible from the media, but there are not many of them out there. So, yeah, Death Row is an upmarket fiction that I wanted to appeal to both suspense fans and to fans of a little more literary storytelling, where we're going to get our hands dirty, so to speak, with the human condition.
Okay, it's time for me to play dime store psychologist here now with you, Ron. How much of that feeling of invisibility or fading away was you projecting?
I think some of it. I think maybe definitely think some of it.
Okay.
I hold out the possibility that more of it is there than I know. Yeah, definitely. I'm just reached Medicare age, mm-hmm. and all of a sudden it starts to make sense, and you start thinking like your grandfather, not your father, and you start seeing yourself in more roles like that, and then you start saying, gee, was the best book I wrote back when I was 40? Or is it going to be somewhere ahead? And you start handicapping the whole thing and saying, well, okay, well, I'm going to be older, or I can move around a little bit better or less. Or it does weigh on me, and it weighed on me. And these guys appeal to me, I think, in ways that they might not appeal to a 21-year-old woman, they're still real. They're still reflections of real people out there. And if somebody comes away from this book and they say, well, that was good crime fiction, I liked the crime, I liked the investigation, mm-hmm. My feelings wouldn't be hurt. But if they get to the end, they say, well, yeah, that was a good crime fiction, and those guys stuck with me, mm-hmm. then good. But yeah, I think you're right. I think nobody has asked me that, not even my wife.
No?
But yeah, I think there's a little of that.
There's also a really good, again, playing dime store psychologist here. There's also a really good lesson I think you projected in through that. And you tell me if I'm maybe projecting a little too much. And that is, as we're advancing in age, the lesson of when to play cowboy and take it to a certain point, and when to be able to acquiesce and ask for help. Is that lesson in there as well?
Maybe. As you're saying that, I'm trying to think, well, how might that have shown up in the book? And nothing leaps to mind, but there's no question that that's an element of growing old, mm-hmm. is that you now have to measure your steps. You have to not lift with your back.
Yes. Yep.
Start lifting with your legs, or lifting with your next door neighbor. But I think so. It's interesting. I've been working on the sequel to the book, and one of the subplots in that, I think, will be the nature of grief among old men when they are among old men.
Ah, okay.
And how that comes out, because old guys, particularly of my fictional character's age, aren't handy with expressing emotion. They don't hug each other and say, "Hey, I love you, man."
Right.
They say, "Hey, you're fatter than you were yesterday."
That's true.
And that's been another interesting thing about this for me, is that this is a kind of ghastly crime that we're dealing with.
Yes.
And it gets into some rather grisly stuff. Mm-hmm. By the same token, there's a lot of humor in this book, and usually the guys amongst themselves. So there was a balancing act there between writing that utterly ghastly, shocking violence with these gentle old guys having fun at each other's expense, and so and in other ways, but it was a challenge for me in that respect. Well, in that respect and others, to blend those two competing ideas of the obligation I have to the crime reader and this urge to tell a more human, to show a more human side of these people.
There's a third thing here, and I think you show in the book too, that I wanted to point out before we go any further and start talking a little bit about the book and about the other characters in the book. And that's this, and I want to tip my cap to you as well as far as this goes, Ron. And it teaches a basic overall lesson, whether you meant to teach it or not. and that is, and I don't. And sometimes we put out little bits of genius, whether we mean to or not. And actually, Mountain Bell does this as well in the book. Sometimes he even cites it a couple times that I can't believe I said that, you know, that one line, I can't believe I said that, you know, when he says it to his former partner. And then when a colleague of his former partner says the exact same line back to him, I can't believe I said that. But the little bit of genius is this, and this is the third lesson that I pulled from the book. And that is, no matter what age you reach, you still have skills that are invaluable to others. And it doesn't matter if the physical body fails, that you still have something to contribute to society.
No, but I think that's absolutely true. And I think that it's kind of inherent in the idea that we have these old guys getting toward the end of their lives and wondering if they still have a purpose, if they still have, if their skills meant anything, which says they had them to begin with. Mm-hmm. And this is as motley a crew as I cared to create. I might get a little more motley as I go here, but their skills in this case are, of course, what we would think of as ordinary, but they actually mean something. And in the context of solving a crime, they mean something. But I think that if absent the crime, they would still mean something. There would still be somebody asking a question about how does a weather vane work? How come my weather vane doesn't work? And somebody who knows can answer that question, and that has value. It's not going to change the world, mm-hmm. but it's going to change one person's world.
Right, exactly.
And I think there's some value to that too. But again, you know, we just see these guys substituting as the, you know, we watch crime drama on TV, the main characters always have a team of people behind them, you know, clicking away at their computers or getting DNA analysis in 37 seconds or, you know, whatever it might be, checking the surveillance cameras or the facial recognition, all of that technical stuff. These guys serve that function, albeit on a level that you mentioned earlier, where they're just recounting, in some cases, things they remember from childhood.
Right.
And in the process, contributing to the solution of the crime.
Right. I tell you what, Ron, let's take our break right here. When we come back, I want to get into some of these characters that surround Mountain Bell. And I want to get into one character in particular, one character that Mountain Bell can never seem to solve, but is probably the closest to him. And that's the character of Charlie. And one that seems to keep him going, one that always seems to feed his curiosity, and one that, let's just say, has solved him more than he solved himself. What am I talking about? Of course, I'm talking in riddles, folks. But we'll get down to it when we come back. The book is Death Row. It's coming out on February 14th, courtesy of Wild Blue Press. You can pre-order it right now. We've got the link in the description of this program. And by gosh, folks, pre-order it right now. I'm telling you, this book was fantastic. I had a great time reading this book and getting to know the characters in this book. And man, has it got twists and turns. It's going to surprise you, folks. And you're going to fall in love with these characters. You're going to fall in love with this book. It is such an easy read, such a great read. Ron Francell is our guest. Death Row is the book. Order it right now in the link in that description right in this program. When we come back, more with Ron Francell. Death Row is the book. We'll talk more about it right after this on the best in true crime podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. Welcome back to the Best in True Crime Podcasting. This is True Crime Tuesday. I'm Tim Dennis. The book is Death Row. Our guest is Ron Francell. He's the author of this true crime fiction book, the one that I had the privilege of sitting down with over the weekend and just absolutely falling in love with. It is such a great book, and I've got to tip my cap to you, Ron. Really falling in love with the characters in this book, everybody from Father Burt to a character by the name of Charlie. I want to talk about Charlie for a second, who is the I don't want to say the one that got away because she's so close to Mountain Bell. Tell us a little bit about Charlie and why Mountain Bell keeps her at an arm's length. And for God's sakes, why does he keep her at an arm's length?
I've wondered that myself. I you know, of course, Mountain Bell is in his 70s. He's retired. He's the cynical, crusty guy that we've been talking about, of course. Charlie is 50-something. Mm-hmm. She's much younger than him, a couple decades. She's pretty when she allows herself to be pretty. She's smart, never married, very tough exterior. She drives a garbage truck, even though she runs the garbage company that she inherited from her father. She's writing a novel, but she won't show it to Bell. She has some of his same commitment anxieties, but she's devoted to him. And they spar lovingly throughout the book and constantly, I might add. But she's the only other person besides Father Burt that Bell lets in, you know, if you so to speak. They have an occasionally sexual relationship, but that's not why they're together. Mm-hmm. In the same way that Father Burt sits on one shoulder as kind of Bell's moral compass, Charlie sits on the other. And she's a more level-headed approach. She has a more level-headed approach to problems. And through her, though, we see some of the softer stuff that Bell tries to hide from the rest of the world. And in that, I think she's just a beautiful character.
That she is. And, you know, she's got her finger right on the pulse of him. She knows how to get in his head. She knows how to scramble it around a little bit and get him thinking in a different direction when maybe he's stuck, whether he's stuck on things on this case that he's dealing with whether he's stuck on something in life or maybe he's just in the wrong headspace. She's really got a way of kind of putting her finger on the pulse of things, scrambling it around a little bit and getting him right back on track to where he should be.
Yeah, I mean, I think all of us guys can think of women out there who are intriguing to us because they don't take any of our guff.
Yeah,
yeah. You know, they don't fall for any of the BS that we can sometimes come up with. And in his case, she knows that he's in real life, in my true crime writing, I talked to a female detective one time who described her older male partner as an M&M. Hard exterior with softer core. And that stuck with me. And I think Bell is that. Bell is a very tough exterior. He would have been a dirty, hairy kind of cop in his heyday. But he's softer inside, and he doesn't show that to anybody. Through Charlie, we see some of that.
We do, and we get that peek inside there. But there are some things that he doesn't want to expose her to, and is that just the fact that he wants to keep her somewhat pure? That's a part of his life that he doesn't want the police work to affect.
I think that could be it. You know, we'll have to explore that in the next book, I guess. But I think too, he's aware of the ghastliness of the world. Mm-hmm. And he's aware of how it has changed him. And insofar as he can keep it from changing other people, he'll do that, especially people that are very close to him. But yeah, he's protective of her in kind of an old-fashioned John Wayne way. And that's part of that age group, I think, in men. If we look around at the guys who are now in their 70s and 80s, we probably see a much more chivalrous, gentlemanly kind of personality than maybe the really young men. Maybe that will change over time too, but it's true of the older guys I've known, and that probably you know, that they take care of the people around them, and they don't want to expose them to the horrors that they've seen. Think of, we talk about the guys who went through World War II coming home, and their kids and grandkids talking about, they never mentioned where they had been or what they had seen, and they just didn't talk about the war. And I think it's kind of typical. In his case, I think he takes it a step farther and wants to protect her a little bit from it. And by the same token, we get a glimpse that Charlie has her own secrets that she's keeping. And so this is going to get complicated, I think. The relationship will get a little more complicated, but I don't see it ending.
It's very interesting that Bell likes to keep things, Mountain Bell likes to keep things compartmentalized.
Yes, absolutely.
And he even does in the closest of relationships. If you don't mind, I want to go a little bit deeper into him and how he keeps him compartmentalized. I'll start with Charlie and the fact that even though he seems to be close to her, the L word never comes out very much with her at all.
No.
They don't cohabitate. They don't live together, but she does spend the night and they go to their separate domiciles.
Right. And right. Not very often. I mean, not very often does she spend the night. It's the And I, you know what? I don't know what goes on behind their closed doors, but okay. It might not be sex. It might just be togetherness. It might just be closeness. But she doesn't spend time there. She doesn't spend nights there typically, which I think is a lot about the kind of what they both find important about their relationship. It's not sex.
And it seems like, and you mentioned there being secrets and like experiences there. I want to shift gears and pivot a little bit here and talk about the other person you mentioned was kind of, you know, Charlie's on one of his shoulders, Father Bert being on the other shoulder, and experiences that are similar. One of the things that Mountain Bell has in common with Father Bert is they both were in Vietnam.
Yeah, they didn't know each other at that time, but Father Bert is a retired Catholic priest in this little town in the mountains, kind of a backwater parish where he's been banished early in his youth for being, like I said earlier, unorthodox, for being kind of a rebel. So he was sent there and then he retired. But he's full of life even now. He has his little quirky behaviors. He likes to hunt. And I don't know how many priests we know like to hunt. He drinks a little bit. He's mildly profane. Not in the taking God's name in vain sense, but
right, yeah.
and he's as rebellious as he is faithful. One experience they share is that Father Bert was a battlefield chaplain in Vietnam. And so he and Bell share the horrors of that war. He is, as I said, one of only two people that Bell lets in. Maybe three. We could include his former partner. But Father Bert functions as that kind of eccentric angel on Bell's shoulder, you know, appealing to that more moral side of him. Bell is not an immoral person. Mm-hmm. It's just that he's given to thinking sometimes that solutions to problems don't always have to be on the up and up. And I think that Father Bert is there to remind him that they both serve a kind of similar function. Mm-hmm. And so they're the closest of friends. But even then, we don't see them hugging and you know, telling each other they love each other, or even engaged in, I don't know, emotional kinds of dialogue. They don't. But that doesn't mean they don't get deep. It just means they don't Bell doesn't really show that side to anybody. And the closest we come will be Father Bert and Charlie. So they function in the story, like I say, as the two sort of angels sitting on opposite shoulders. And one is tending to Bell's moral thinking, and the other is tending to a sort of practical thinking and keeping him from descending too deeply into bitterness and anger and submitting to the things that he's seen in his life.
I guess you could say, I'm trying to find the most accurate description for Father Bert, because he's not really, you know, Bell doesn't really depend on him to be his moral center. In fact, it's the exact opposite. He doesn't want him to be his moral center.
No, he doesn't. He doesn't want that. He doesn't want that restriction.
In fact, he's almost trying to shove him off of him when Father Bert wants to be his moral center, when he wants to weigh in and wants to give him a moral compass in which he wants him to follow. It seems like Bell wants anything but that. You know, and when Father Bert nails it on the head, what he's thinking, he wants to run as far away from that as possible. Would that be accurate?
I think so. I think you when you think about the world that Woodrow Bell has come from, where he's seen the death in Vietnam, where he's seen so much ghastliness on the streets of Denver and in his life with him. And he, another little backstory is, you know, he's been married, had child, and that didn't work out. And so he's coming to the end of his life by himself. He regrets that, but he is in no hurry to fix that. He regrets the choices he made in the past and sees them as probably unfixable at this point. And so he wants to be alone. He doesn't really like associating with people much at all, except these few guys that he gets together with. And even then, it's a difficult relationship in that he just doesn't want to show that softer side, and to a degree that it wasn't that it got him in trouble in the past. It's just that he lost faith in the softer stuff. You know, he what worked for him was being hard, mm-hmm. as a cop, as a Marine. And he'll ride that horse to the end.
There's a little bit of a bet or a little bit of a taunt between Bell and Father Bert. And it's interesting how this changes throughout the book. Even when we get to, and we're going to get to the plot here in a little bit, to kind of sweeten this up for everybody, our listening audience, because we've been talking about the characters, but we haven't really gotten down to the story in which Steph Rowe, revolves around. And that's this, that Bell kind of taunts Father Bert with the fact that he really doesn't think there's much there after we die. He really just, he's seen so much death that he thinks, you know what, maybe we just kind of float up into the clouds, or maybe we're just nothing but dust when we die and that's it. Yeah. And Father Bert says, well, you know what, my son, I really do believe there's something after we die, that, you know, there's God, there's Jesus, there's everything that is, you know, in my canon. And they're at the stalemate. But as we continue into our story, and Bell starts to see the horrors that are unfolding in this case, it really seems like Bell wants to believe some of the things that Father Bert believes.
I think so. I think he's reassured by the possibility that some of this terrible, I keep talking about the ghastliness, but some of this horror is only here. It's only in this life, and that there's another life where victims and others will be redeemed, I guess. That said, it's not, it's more that this opposing thinking here that's going on between them, I think, is more the struggle between the agnostic mind and the faithful mind, without making this a religious text. I that wasn't my intention. I just wanted to show some of the struggles between some of the struggles of an old man.
But that's one of the more intriguing things about the book, Ron, is the fact that you have a man who's not only lost in the fact that he he's just lost in life. But we're all lost, I think, at one time or another as to what happens when we die.
Well, exactly. I tell you a story. Up to COVID, I volunteered in a program at the Veterans Administration. And we were the only two guys hired for this. I mean, they would have loved to have more people, but more people didn't volunteer. The two of us stepped up. And our job was to go into the VA hospital two, three times a week between us and spend the night with veterans who were dying. And they were in the hospice, and there was nobody, no family, no friends were visiting. They were alone, and they were going to die alone. And our job was to sit with them and just have conversations and just be their friend. And you know, it happened occasionally that we were there when they died. And so they didn't die alone. But the idea that that there was somebody who cared about them at the end was what drove this program. And it was the most rewarding thing I've done with my spare time in my life. And to hear these guys, all the ones that were still awake and could talk, they asked questions that you and I don't contemplate yet, you know, about dignity and about pain. The ones that were, we had to work generally overnight from about 10 at night till 6 in the morning, because their days were messed up with medicine and with surgeries and things like that. But a lot of them, too many of them, wouldn't go to sleep anyway, because they felt if they went to sleep, that might be it. They might not wake up, and they didn't want it to happen like that. So I'm translating some of that to my guys in death row. This fear of going to sleep in a sort of theoretical way, right? This fear of not being awake for the rest of it.
I completely understand that feeling. And you know what? You brought that feeling across very well. I mean, throughout the entire book, even down to when somebody doesn't show up in the morning to Tommyknockers, the fact that they're all afraid that maybe they passed away in their sleep.
Right. Right.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we know from you and I both, from talking to older people, that an old codger might open up the paper in the morning, that they don't read the front page. They go right to the obituaries to see if anybody they know is mentioned.
Yeah.
And it's a completely different perspective. And so as Bell struggles to stay in the game, these things are still going on in his head. He's getting old. He has less time ahead than he has time that's passed. And I don't see this as a downer book,
no.
That it's bogged down in questions about dying and growing old and whether there's a God, but that it does come up in a couple of their conversations. Sure. And in a couple cases, I try to make it very light and kind of fun in a way, but I have to remember that I came here, this book is in front of you because it's a murder mystery and there's this crime going on.
We're going to get to that here in a second, Ron. I don't want people to get the wrong idea here. There's a lot of fun banter and play between the characters. There's a lot of ribbing, a lot of joking. I don't want to make people think that this is the overwhelming theme of the book, but you have some very interesting themes kind of in between the jokes, kind of in between the ribbing and the rivalry, in between different characters, which intrigued me. So I wanted to bring them up.
Absolutely. And that was the point.
Yeah.
So, they intrigue you.
Yeah, they intrigue me. And I wanted to figure out where they stemmed from or where they came from. So I want to get to the plot of this book. And I'm leaving out a little hanging, and there's a little hanging thread throughout this book too, having to do with his daughter, Sarah, but I'm going to leave that one. Because he does have a daughter, Sarah, who he's estranged from. We mentioned her a little bit here, but it seems like he's always trying to get a hold of her, but he's just missing her. And I just have the one question for you about her, and that is there a reason for the dangling thread of having her there but not quite getting to her?
Yes, because I think our relationship as older adults with our adult children mm-hmm. has changed naturally from when they were kids, and it gets more complicated. And so that's why that's there, is a kind of nod to the fact that old folks like Belle have kids and they have complicated relationships with them. It's a thread that's left untied, because I always saw it as being something that was ongoing. Okay. That they might repair in some way, but there's work to be done. I don't know. But I left it as something to be explored in future installments of the book, but also to show Belle as a father who wasn't disengaged. Mm-hmm. I mean, genuinely disengaged, that he didn't care. He does care. He just has a hard time. He has a hard history, and he has a hard time showing that he cares to everybody. But here's this daughter character who you can see him struggling to give a voice to how he feels, but being frustrated in that. And I'm assuming that she has a good reason to feel the way she does too.
Okay. So essentially, Mountain Belle is given this case by Father Burt. And I'll let you take it from here, Ron, as to what exactly this case is and why does it intrigue Mountain Belle to jump into it at this advanced age that he's at in his 70s? And why does he feel like he needs to prove himself?
You know, he resists in the beginning. He doesn't really want to get into it. He knows he's been there before. He's got the t-shirt, right?
Mm-hmm.
He just doesn't want to get into it. He doesn't care that much, at least outwardly, you know. And here we get back to that thing of what he shows outwardly might not be the thing that's going on inwardly, but he doesn't want to get involved. Keeping it at arm's length is better than inviting that in. But it involves the disappearance, you know, 30, 40 years before of a teenage girl in their small town. She was eventually found murdered, in a terrible way. And she's the daughter of a guy that they know in the small town in their same age, but he's declining from dementia. And Belle's reluctance to get involved in the crime or in the investigation of the crime is partly because he realized he doesn't have the same tools as before. He doesn't have the same drive. He doesn't have the same physical abilities. But he just wants to fade away. Mm-hmm. He just wants to be done. And if the end is coming, he doesn't want to make it too complicated. Here's where Father Burt plays that role and kind of slowly, gently tugs him into it, He gets involved. He decides. He agrees simply to ask a few questions. Those few questions intrigue him enough that he wants to ask a few more. And pretty soon he's in it up to his knees. But that he still has some sort of practical difficulties in that he doesn't have the resources that a full-time cop with a big city homicide desk would have. And that's why he turns to these guys. But in time, he realizes that there might be clues enough there that they actually could solve it. And that the killer who hit this teenage girl decades before might still be around and might have actually done the same thing to other girls in other small towns throughout the Colorado Rockies, which appeals to the cop in him, which appeals to that John Wayne kind of protector, a chivalrous guy who wants to do the right thing. When he factors in that this girl's father might soon have no recollection even of her, that sort of ramps up the drive to solve the crime so that he could at least tell a father that he solved that father's he solved the crime that was at the heart of this father's greatest disappointment.
There's also one other thing here too, Ron, is when things start to ramp up, when he realizes that there's probably other girls involved here, he does reach out to an old partner of his that he helped bring up through the ranks of the Denver Police Department. And at one point, they both cite something, which is very interesting to me. And again, I'm going to try to do this without spoilers. and I realize we're tiptoeing around to do this without spoilers because we want people to pick up the book and really read this. And I want people to pick up this book.
Yeah, we don't want to solve the crime for him
right,
on the radio.
Exactly. But one of the interesting things that's brought up in this book, which really weighs on the psyche of especially the Colorado or Denver area police, or even the state of Colorado itself, that you bring up in the book, which I find fascinating, is not making mistakes. The one mistake that you bring up in the book, which is a glaring mistake, is Bundy. Just one word, mm-hmm. Bundy.
Yeah.
Tell me why you threw that in the book. The fact that is weighing so heavily on law enforcement's mind when this case comes up in this particular fiction book, that they want to get it right. They don't want to make any mistakes. Bundy.
Well, of course, Ted Bundy was arrested in Colorado in the 70s, and they had him early on, and they had him on a good case. But Bundy escapes. From a small town courthouse and escapes until he's run to ground much, much later and many more victims later. In reality, there are a lot of people in Colorado who, in law enforcement in Colorado, who look at that and are a little embarrassed by that mistake that led to Bundy escaping. So they don't want to repeat that. And so Bundy hangs out there as a kind of ghost that's haunting. When Bell brings up this case and they start to believe that this is a serial killer who's more prolific in Colorado than Ted Bundy. and certainly more brutal, then they see that as a chance to maybe redeem themselves a little bit, or maybe as a chance to screw up again and have to live through that as being the, you know, the keystone cops of serial killers. That element is there as, you know, driving them to succeed and driving them to put as much resource into it as they possibly could, and to not be embarrassed, which is a powerful thing for all of us. I played sports when I was younger. I didn't want to get hurt. I definitely didn't want to get hurt. Nobody wants to get hurt.
Yep.
But worse than that, I didn't want to be embarrassed.
Yeah,
I didn't want to be embarrassed in front of a crowd full of people, a stadium full of people. So that's a powerful motivation for a lot of us, and it is a motivation in crime investigation. In my book Shadow Man, the real story, the crime that drives the book gets a lot of attention from the local sheriff because he had failed on a crime 5 or 6 years before and suffered politically for it. And he didn't want to repeat that. So it's real. It's a real motivator. The Bundy thing, to a certain degree, is a real motivator in Colorado, too, although less and less the longer we go.
Well, we all know, Ron, to use a sports analogy, in order to make a big play, you have to make a big move.
That's right.
And if you make
big risks,
big risk. And if you make that big move or that big risk, there's a chance that you're going to be burned.
Absolutely. That's the risk.
Yeah.
And, some of that comes out here, as we hurtle toward the conclusion of the book. I think Bell, this crusty old guy, is reverting to the younger Bell and taking more risks and being more, I don't know, really getting into it and being the thoughtful guy that he didn't see himself becoming.
It's a fair analogy. Fair analogy. I think with that, we'll stop so that people can pick this up and see it for themselves, Ron. Again, the book is Death Row. It comes out February 14th of this year, 2023, on Wild Blue Press. And we'll have a link in the description of this program so that you can pick it up for yourself. I encourage you folks to pre-order that book, get a hold of it, and fall in love with the characters like I did. Because like I said, I had an absolute wonderful time with this book. Sitting down with it, getting to know the characters. There's lots of good humor in this book, as well as some, I tell you, just some on the edge of your seat type scenarios where you're wondering if the characters are going to get through it, if they're going to find this killer or not. Some, if I can just go ahead and say it, Ron, some oh shit moments. there really are some great moments in this book, Ron, and again, I tip my cap to you for it, putting together.
You're so
a wonderful
kind.
Story.
Thank you.
So, yeah.
Thank you for having me, Tim. I appreciate it. We've always had a good time.
Absolutely, my friend. Absolutely, and I'll look forward to the sequel because I want to see where this goes.
Me too.
Yeah. Absolutely. Absolutely. Again, the book is Death Row, February 14th on Wild Blue Press. Check it out, folks. I'd like to thank Ron Francell for joining us today with his book, Death Row. Go get it on Wild Blue Press. Comes out on February 14th of this year. Go ahead and pre-order that book at wildbluepress.com. Tomorrow on Darkness Radio, Reverend Oresti Diaversa will be talking about death and the pandemic. I didn't get to say goodbye. Now what do I do? Reverend Diaversa will join us. And he'll be talking not just about the pandemic and losing someone during the pandemic and being able to say goodbye to that person, even though you didn't have the chance to say goodbye to that person in person, but we'll also be talking about traumatic deaths. What happens when you lose somebody to a fatal accident or you lose somebody suddenly and you don't have that chance to say goodbye. How do we deal with traumatic deaths? And how do we get that chance to say goodbye even though we didn't get to face someone last time? That's Reverend Oreste Diaversa tomorrow on Darkness Radio. Folks, thank you so much for tuning in today. And again, we'll see you tomorrow on the best in paranormal programming, Darkness Radio. Thank you so much for joining us again today on the best in true crime podcasting. This has been True Crime Tuesday.